topic tonight, which I thought was a little provocative, is about the issue of Avatar. How many of you saw that movie? Actually, the producer of the movie, he always works with James Cameron and all these big movies like Titanic and Terminator and so on, John Landau, is a close friend of a close friend of mine. And he mentioned that he got a lot of this stuff from the Krishna tradition. I mean, that's why the people are blue and they have a mark on their forehead and so on. So, so first of all, I will explain what the word avatar means technically in Sanskrit. No, it's okay. It's not broken. Don't fix it. The Sanskrit word avatar is composed of two elements, ava and tara. Ava in Sanskrit, of course, means downward. And tara means crossing. So the notion here is that there, just as there's a physical realm, which is basically the world that we experience with our senses, there's also a metaphysical realm. The word meta, the Greek prefix meta, means beyond or after. So metaphysics, I think a term coined by Aristotle. The term metaphysics actually means that which is beyond the physical. And interestingly, we here in America, or practically in every other country, we do in fact admit and acknowledge and recognize that there is an objective metaphysical realm. Although we may not know we're doing that. It's like, for example, everyone, even if someone doesn't know much about psychology, everyone's got one. Everyone's got a psychology. Whether or not they study themselves or study psychology. And so just as everyone has a psychology, whether or not they study psychology, everyone has a philosophy, whether or not they study philosophy. And so just as with psychology, since you've got one, it's probably better to know something about it. Similarly, it's, I think, healthy to know something about what our philosophy is, rather than just holding certain philosophical positions without any self-awareness that we're doing so. So to give an example of an amazing metaphysical and one, I think, would be tempted to say religious assumption, which is actually the basis of our entire political and social system, interestingly, since apparently we're in a secular democracy, and that is the assumption of equality. The assumption of equality. This is that we're all equal. This is an a priori assumption. In other words, it's not something which we... It's not that we're going to, you know, do a bunch of empirical experiments and if they don't come out the right way, we'll change our political system. It's an a priori assumption that we are somehow equal. And democracy, of course, is based on that principle of equality. And if you look at the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson was quite explicit. It is a metaphysical, even a religious assumption. He was quite explicit about that. When he said that we hold these truths to be self-evident. Self-evident is a philosophical term, epistemological term, meaning something which proves itself and therefore cannot be pushed into an infinite regress of proofs. So Jefferson said that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that we are all created equal. Created equal. Endowed by the Creator with certain equal rights. So the modern view of that is that there are human rights. There were just, in other words, somehow because we are anatomically human, we have certain rights. And I think Jefferson was actually a much better philosopher than modern people. And we'll get to the avatar in a second. I just wanted to make the point that everyone has metaphysical assumptions. Jefferson... One last philosophical point. Sorry for all this philosophy. I don't know. It must be something I ate earlier today. But The famous Scottish philosopher David Hume pointed out, Hume's contribution was that you cannot derive a metaphysical truth from a physical fact. In other words, if you look at our human anatomy, the fact that we are physiologically or anatomically human, where do the rights come from? You can study everything about human anatomy, and you're not going to come across any object, any perceptible object, which is a right. So to have a right is a metaphysical fact. Our human anatomy is physical. All these contradictions are there. But the reason I mention this is because all of us say justice. These are all metaphysical assumptions. So all of us really believe that beyond the physical world, there is an objective metaphysical realm in which certain non-empirical facts are true about the universe, such as equality, such as justice, being a desirable thing, and so on and so forth, that we have certain rights. Now, in India, I think you would have to say, was intellectually very precocious. If you study the history of human civilizations, you'll find that, for example, the first great universities were in India. Actually, Buddhist universities in places like Nalanda, which predate the European university system by several centuries. India was very advanced in the scientific study of language, the modern Western discipline, or not Western, but just academic discipline of linguistics, actually came from the discovery of the ancient Indian study of language. That's a whole other topic. And also in terms of philosophy, theology, logic, epistemology, ontology, whatever, India actually was, in many ways, ahead of its times. So, In this ancient tradition, just one thing, you have to look at India before the sort of like these brutalizing and culturally devastating colonialist invasions. There were a series of Muslim invasions beginning about 1,000 years ago. And with these invasions, the Muslim invaders actually declared that one of their explicit goals was to destroy Indian culture. And then, of course, you had the English soiree in India. So if we look at India pre-colonialism, if we look at pre-colonial India, we find a civilization which in many ways, and we go on and on about this, just this topic, very advanced. In any case, in India and in other parts of the world, such as in classical Greco-Roman civilization, there was a clear assumption that this physical world that we now live in, whether it's Madison, Wisconsin, or Timbuktu, which apparently is North Africa, that this material world is, in a sense, a lower realm, that there are higher realms of existence, higher dimensions, and we as conscious beings, we as conscious mortal beings, as value-holding beings, the fact that we don't merely pursue our gross bodily needs. We don't just go and capture our prey and eat it, or, you know, bathe in a river or reproduce because of some urge. And then, in other words, we're not merely animals. We actually can think. There are no great universities like this, as far as we know, among other species of life on Earth. So as thinking creatures, as creatures that hold values, that sometimes we do things not merely because it satisfies some immediate bodily need, but because it's the right thing to do. For example, justice, equality, and so on and so forth, mercy. So the ancient Vedic civilization, for that matter, many other, I mean, the classical Greco-Roman civilization, at least some of the great philosophers, Plato, Plotinus, and so on and so forth, recognized that we as conscious beings, we as beings that hold values, we actually ultimately belong to a spiritual realm. And by that I mean that there's even now in the realm of science actually a view which is sort of getting a bit of a buzz called biocentrism. It's called, I don't know if you read about this, biocentrism. It's a philosophical position which has actually emerged from the physical sciences, the idea that consciousness is actually primary, sort of a typical Vedanta position. So getting to the avatar, that was just a little preface. And the avatar, literally the down crosser, that's what the word literally means, a down crosser, one who crosses down. And so that means there is a realm, a dhyatma realm in Sanskrit, or a spiritual realm, a transcendental realm, which is populated, which has its own, you could say, spiritual demographics. There is actually a spiritual realm. In Sanskrit, it can be called paraloka. The word paradise, actually, in English, comes from a Sanskrit paradesha. Paradesha means the land beyond, paradesha. And from that Sanskrit, I think through Arabic, we get the English word paradise. You find the same idea in Buddhism, in the figure of the bodhisattva, the idea that the compassionate, pure soul comes down to this world to help us. So, the Avatar. Now, the movie, regarding the movie, it was Hollywood. And I know they tried. There were a few things which weren't technically accurate in the movie, although I don't want to bash the movie because I thought it was really well done. But in any case, the Avatar comes from a higher realm down to a lower realm. So you could say that figure, I forgot his name in the movie. What was it, the guy? Anyone remember his name? Yeah, Jake. So if you think that the human world he was coming from was higher, then he came down. Of course, in the movie, he was an avatar in the sense that he inhabited another body. So he came into another body and took on a type of virtual identity. So in the original sense of the word avatar, this is a common Sanskrit word, one who crosses down into this realm. The idea is that, of course, there's a god. There's a god in this system, Ishwara. As Aristotle, the father of modern logic, felt that it was a philosophical necessity, a logical necessity. That ultimately, if you're trying to logically understand reality, that there must be some origin of everything. There must be some principle that explains other principles. And you find the same intellectual quest in the sciences, in physics, for example, the idea, the urge to find a fundamental principle, a type of ultimate principle that explains all other principles, so that you can state things in the simplest, most elegant possible way. So Aristotle came to the conclusion that the most elegant expression or explanation of reality must involve what he called an unmoved mover, because the world is really just this universe of causes and effects. And ultimately, there must be, unless there's an infinite regress of causes and effects, there must be ultimately an unmoved mover, a cause which has no cause, a cause of all causes which itself is not caused. And that's exactly the same definition we find not only in Aristotle, but also in the Vaishnava tradition of India. For example, the statement, Ishwara Paramakrishna Sachidananda Vigraha Anadi Radhi Govinda. That Krishna or Govinda is the origin of everything, he has no origin, sarva karana karana, the cause of all causes. So, especially in the Vaishnava, now India, if you look at Hinduism is sort of a modern term. If you look at the history of the use of the word Hinduism, the history of the word, not the history of Hinduism, but the history of that word, it's very interesting. We can actually identify three historical stages of the use of that word, the word Hindu in India. The first stage is simply not used, because as we know, the word Hindu is a mispronunciation of the Sanskrit word Sindhu. The Sanskrit word Sindhu means a large body of water, and was the name of an important river which flows today through what is Pakistan, which was all originally the same civilization, the same country. So the people on the west side of the river pronounced the word Sindhu Hindu. You find the same tendency actually in the Sanskrit, or let's say in the anyway, I won't give you a bunch of linguistics. Well, just a little bit. The Greek homo, as in homogeneous, is actually a Sanskrit samo. So the S becomes an H. Also, if you know about the Zoroastrian tradition, Ahura Mazda was the ancient Persian god. The word Ahura is from the Sanskrit Asura, and so on. So the S became an H, and so Sindhu became Hindu. And when the people on the west side of the river, the Persians, eventually were converted to Islam and then invaded India, they brought that mispronunciation with them. And of course, the Greeks, who were next to the Persians, didn't pronounce an H at the beginning of a word, so Hindu became Indu in India. In any case, so the first stage of Indian history, there is no word Hindu in India. It doesn't exist. The word just doesn't exist in India. In fact, the word India doesn't exist. Bharat Varsha. Then, with the Muslim invasion, the Muslims basically called everyone in India Hindu. Hindu simply meant a non-Muslim. It's like the Jews have this all-encompassing term, Gentile, which means anyone that's not Jewish. And so in the same way, when the Muslim invaders called everybody in India, including Buddhists, people that follow the Vedas, everyone that wasn't a Muslim was a Hindu. So, interestingly, if you study Indian literature, let's say from about 500 years ago, what you find is that what Indians might refer to as Sanatana Dharmis, people who follow the Vedas, people who accept this body of literature sacred, the Vedas, they would never refer to themselves as Hindus. They would never refer to themselves as Hindus, but when they were speaking to Muslims, they would refer to themselves as Hindus. Usually, when you look at Indian literature from about 500 years ago, what you find is that when a Vaidika Dharmi or Sanatana Dharmi, someone who follows the Vedic scriptures of India, when that person is talking to a Muslim, the Muslim would refer to the Indian as a Hindu, and sometimes they would refer to themselves that way just to communicate with Muslims, but they would never refer to themselves that way when talking to themselves. In other words, when someone who followed the Vedas was talking to someone else who followed the Vedas, they would never refer to themselves as Hindus. It was only for conversation with Muslims. Now, that's the second stage. The third stage of the use of this word is with the English invasion. With the English invasion of India and taking over India, what you find is that the English, in some ways, their attempt to culturally control India, in some ways, is more crude than the Muslims, but in some ways, it was more sophisticated because England came to India and really began to assert its political control over India, especially at a time when Europe was culturally ascendant. You had all this explosion of technology, the European universities and so on. And so it was seductive to many young, intelligent Indian people. And therefore, about 100, 200 years ago, there was sort of an attempt to circle the wagons. And then later, 100 years ago, figures like Dr. Radhakrishnan, Vivekananda, who explicitly sort of create the notion that we're all Hindus, which is somewhat ahistorical, by the way. Somewhat ahistorical because it was sort of created about 100, 150 years ago. Because previous to that, people identified themselves as Shaktas, Vaishnavas, Shaivas, Tantrikas, and so on and so forth. There were many different traditions in India. And so the idea that that there's one religion called Hinduism is probably less than 150 years old as such. Although, of course, the Vedic tradition is very ancient. Getting back to Avatar. So within this ancient tradition, the idea is that we ourselves are spiritual beings. And that, in fact, is the real, as Thomas Jefferson noted, that's why we're equal. Because every living being, and this is not only human beings. This, of course, is not only human beings. It's not an anthropo-chauvinism. This is not anthropocentric. This is not simply a type of chauvinistic humanism. That because we are humans, therefore we only care about humans and other people have no rights and no... and whatever. This is actually a concern for all living beings. So the idea is that every living being is originally a spiritual being, and that if we can ascend, in the Gita, Krishna talks about ascending through yoga, yogaru rukshu, one who is ascending through yoga, then by reviving our original spiritual nature, we then can choose to come back to this world, or we can choose to be concerned about this world. Plato talks about a cave, when someone comes out of the darkness of the cave and sees the real world, then goes back into the cave to help others. The Buddha's Bodhisattva is supposed to come back to this world compassionately and help other beings. And so in order for us to cross down, become avatars in a sense, first we have to go up, you know, because you can't come down if you haven't gone up. So there's the notion, of course, very important notion in all the traditions of India, Hindu and Buddhist, of Dharma. Actually, George Lucas sort of got his idea of the Force from this. And the idea of Sanatana Dharma is that we have an eternal nature. And the present body, or the present body that we're in now, is simply a type of virtual reality machine. And because we identify with this body, in the Avatar movie, when he went into that other Avatar body, then he experienced everything. He experienced everything through that body, pleasure and pain and so on and so forth. And so in that way, all of us, in a sense, are incarnations. The Latin word carne means flesh. And so all of us are actually incarnations. And not in a positive sense, though. Not divine incarnations. We're simply identifying with the body, thinking I'm Indian, I'm an American, I'm male, I'm female, I'm so many years old, I belong to this family, that caste, whatever. And so we identify with the body and get drawn into the virtual reality of the material world. And if we can cultivate the consciousness that we are not the body, we are actually eternal spiritual beings, then we can again become conscious of a spiritual world. And then we can choose to come as avatars, so to speak. We can choose to come to this world and help others. Otherwise, the identification with this body is a horse that's not going to win the race. The body is temporary, and if we get drawn into this identification with the body, rather than seeing ourselves as spiritual beings, it's a very predictable movie. You know, at the end, you die. And then you have to go on, and you have to, you know, try again. And so the Vedic civilization was really based on this. It was really an attempt to bring people to this higher understanding. Now, as far as the chanting that we did before the lecture, if you study world religions, you'll find that virtually in all world religions, without exception, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, you'll find there is a notion of a holy name of God. Of a holy name of God. And why holy? What does it mean, the Harinam? The idea is that God, being absolute, is present in his name. And so by chanting, we are actually in a state of yoga, and in this age, this is considered to be the easiest process to revive that consciousness. So, if you think about it, if you go up in a rocket ship, for example, now you can, of course, buy a ticket on a rocket ship, you actually, you know, you go inside the rocket, and then when the rocket goes up, you go up. And so the idea is that if you connect yourself to God through this chanting, then you're elevated. You are actually elevated. Your consciousness is elevated. So, there's a whole science of this called Bhakti Yoga. It's Adhyatma Vidya, spiritual science. And the Avatar movie was, many things were borrowed from this Vedic culture. I think it was positive in the sense that it introduced people to some of the basic terms and a few concepts, and now hopefully we can present more of this spiritual science more accurately. Anyway, I don't want to go on too long, so if you have any questions on any of these topics. What's that? Oh, yes. Yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah, the concept of Pandora was really very Vedantic, wasn't it?
I don't know.
Oh. Yeah. It's the notion that all life is connected, not just human life. In America, our legal system and our attitudes toward life are quite, I don't want to use a harsh term like schizophrenic, but irrational. In this sense that if you look at let me begin by saying, then I'll get to the point of the, that the worst kind of government, I think we could agree on, the worst kind of government is a government in which the governed have no rights and they simply live or die at the whim or at the pleasure of the ruler. You know, like the Roman emperor puts his thumb up or down. And so in America, if an animal makes a cute urban pet, because now most people live in cities, so if an animal makes a cute urban pet, it has all kinds of rights. I mean, there was an NFL quarterback, which is, you know, American aristocracy, who went to jail for a few years for mistreating dogs. So, and yet if an animal doesn't make a cute urban pet, or doesn't make an adorable urban pet, if it's not a dog or a cat, then you can do anything to it. You can, you know, brutalize it, you can murder millions of them, and no one goes to jail. So again, our present system does not recognize any rights in the creatures themselves. It's just, you know, creatures have rights or don't have rights at the whim of the rulers, which is us. So human beings rule the earth. And so I think that Pandora was a place in the movie where people understood that actually there's an interconnectedness of all life, that all life is connected. And interestingly, in the movie, all life is connected through the deity, through the divinity, through the divine. So it's ultimately what was the name of the divine force? I forgot in the movie.
The tree of swords.
Yeah, well, they pray to it. The divine, anyway, the deity kind of mobilizes all the different life forms, so it becomes a dog pile on the wicked humans, specifically the wicked white male humans. So, it's kind of predictable. So, but that's the idea, that actually the divine, God, or whatever word you use, actually connects all life so that all living beings equally share in that divine existence. And therefore, there's ultimately a family of all life forms. So, that was something which comes very much from India. If you look at ancient civilizations, it was really a trademark of Indian philosophy, that notion that you find there was a Greek ambassador to India about 2,300 years ago, Megasthenes, who wrote a book on India called Indica, which means in Greek, about India. And it was apparently a huge bestseller in the ancient world, this book about India. And in that book, he mentions that India was a very advanced civilization, that there was no slavery in India, unlike Greece and other parts of the world, Egypt, there was no slavery in India. And he also mentions that there are hospitals for animals and, of course, for human beings. And that the government sends government agents all around the country to make sure that no living thing is mistreated. So this was quite ahead of its time. So just how we have terms like racism or sexism. And so I think the next moral frontier is speciesism. I mean, if you think, what's the essence of racism or sexism? The essence is that if someone's body is different than my body, they have no rights. Only people whose bodies are just like my body actually have rights. People have to be just like me physically to have rights. And so in the same way, the idea that creatures of other species have no rights because they're different, even though they may be like take whales. I mean, we know whales and porpoises, they have a, you know, fairly high degree of consciousness. I mean, they certainly seem more intelligent than some humans, I admit. And so... And there are now, I mean, we get like the first little glimmers, the first little attempts in Europe, in Western Europe. I mean, the issue is coming up, like about, I think in Spain, maybe North, the issue is coming up about rights for these creatures. Because unless you link rights to consciousness, if you don't link rights to consciousness, then why do we have rights? I mean, why do we have human rights? Is it just because every species kind of defends its own species? So because we're humans, we just have that animal urge to defend other humans? Or is there some more serious reason to say that we have human rights? And if somehow our rights are tied to our level of consciousness, what about other conscious beings? Why don't they have rights? Why does, for example, why does a retarded a human being have rights? He gets into all kinds of interesting moral issues. So yeah, Pandora, that was the idea. That there is a divine force which pervades nature. Just as Krishna says in the Gita, Mayatatam idang sarvam, I pervade all this universe. And so, therefore, that divine force, as we find in the Gita, is within all creatures. Pandita samadarshina. So, that was the message, I think. It was not only an environmental message, but it was a message that all life is somehow divine. All life is somehow connected to the divine. To what?
To survival instinct.
Like evolution.
Evolution.
Like morality, all like, you know, talk about morality, I mean, can we define that? Can we link that to our urge to survive? I mean, deep down.
I think that, personally, I feel that just as, you could say in the Dark Ages, which is a term the Renaissance people gave to that period, they called it the Dark Ages. It's not our modern term. The Dark Ages, everything had to be explained, let's say, in basic terms of the Bible. It's like, why do we have different languages in the world? Forget linguistics, it's just the Tower of Babel. And so I don't want to put down tracing everything, including the creation of the earth of the Bible, but in a sense, there's a new creationism. I mean, there are sort of two kinds of creationism, which I find to be intellectually equally naive. One is that, you know, the young earth, the earth is 5,000 years old or whatever. The other one is, everything is evolution. It's like that explains everything. There's nothing else on heaven or earth which cannot be explained by the blind forces of nature, natural selection. It's become an all-encompassing, and frankly, I think almost obsessive and fanatical creation myth. So I think you know, according, like Newton said, action equal and opposite reaction. I think that it's not a coincidence that the sort of the secular creation myth is just as naive and almost silly as the one which it's apparently responding to. So the idea that we don't do anything except for brute survival. Oh yeah, there's an attempt to explain everything, but again, that's just the secular creation myth. Actually, because if you take that, you see, if you take that seriously, if you take that creation myth seriously, then let's say you have a child and you want to protect your child, or let's say someone wants to harm your child. There's nothing wrong with harming your child. There's nothing wrong with harming you. It's just that you're programmed. You're just genetically programmed to imagine that it's immoral. And we really want to go down that road. We really want to go down that road that actually there is no right and wrong. There is no right and wrong. And therefore, let's say you overcome your genetic conditioning and you go ahead and kill anyone you like because you realize that it was just a myth. That somehow you were just programmed by evolution to falsely believe that there even is such a thing as morality or immorality. And since only physical things really exist, only empirically verifiable things really exist, there's no such thing as right or wrong because they're not empirical objects. I mean, you find, you know, this idea was already going around 150 years ago. You see it in Dostoevsky's novel, Crime and Punishment. With that nihilist Raskolnikov, who decides he's going to kill an innocent person just for the sheer sort of intellectual experience of it, because human morality is just it's a myth. So are we really prepared to say that all the evil in the world, you know, murdering, raping, exploiting, enslaving, none of this is actually wrong because there's no such thing as immoral? We have just been, evolution has just told us a fairy tale. It's like Plato says that the government sometimes should tell the people myths. In order to keep people moral, sometimes the government has to tell them stories. So Plato says, so is that just a story? Is evolution just telling us a fairy tale because it somehow favorable for our, the survival of our gene pool. But actually, there is no such thing as right or wrong. Do we really want to, is that really where we want to go? Do we believe that our deepest instincts, our deepest intuitions, that some things are really wrong, like if you see someone brutalizing an innocent, completely innocent person, a child, that everything inside of you that's screaming out that this is evil, that's all an illusion, that's just a fairy tale. There's nothing wrong with it at all, because there's no such thing as wrong. So I think it's actually a pretty monstrous idea. And by the way, Hitler, I think it should be noted, was a big fan of Darwin. Now, you can't blame Darwin for that. I'm not retroactively blaming Darwin. I'm simply saying that if you want to see where things can lead, the whole Nazi program of eugenics, they thought they were actually, you know, faithfully carrying out the Darwinian program. Maybe. It may be a misuse. I mean, it's certainly from a moral standpoint, from the standpoint of anyone who knows that there is right and wrong in the world, it's a monstrous use of it. But to say misuse, I mean, if you look at Darwinism, it's just like, you know, Darwin's original teachings. And again, I'm not trying to vilify Darwin, especially, you know, so near his, 200th anniversary or something. You know, he's a birthday boy. But the point is, if you look at sort of classical Darwinism, how do you logically derive a moral imperative not to do what the Nazis did? If you look at Darwin's system as a system of thought, and after all, the secular program is that that's all you need. You shouldn't introduce anything spiritual, although you are allowed to introduce equality, even though it's a spiritual idea. But anyway, never mind the inconsistency. But if you look at Darwin and look at his system of thought, how do you derive the moral imperative not to do what Hitler did? In other words, in what sense? And I'm asking honestly. This is not a rhetorical question, because I'm prepared to learn something here. My question is: what in Darwin would refute or contradict what Hitler did? Yes, please.
If Darwin believed in speciation, which is what you're talking about, then as a species, our brains would have evolved to know what's better for the collection.
Right.
So, right and wrong could also be described evolutionarily as our brains being able to conceive.
Right.
So even though we say they are not physical, our brains have evolved to the point that we can determine them. So
okay.
It's an evolutionary trend. And in terms of
faith, yes.
In terms of Hitler,
yes.
Near and dear to my patient, I mean heart, is that it is better for us to protect the young or protect, you know, globally. And so if we have evolved with that component, I'll just answer exactly in your words. It is actually a physical imperative that we protect our species. So there is a wrong,
right.
There is a right. We have evolved to the point where we no longer are killing neighboring tribes or wherever this came from. And so I would just say to you that those two things are exactly in line with what Darwin could understand 200 years ago.
Very,
our brains have evolved. They
right.
Continue to evolve.
Okay.
And so you can't say just because right and wrong is something you think about metaphysically. When
right. Okay.
And our body, so that our species.
So are you saying that we evolved to the point of imagining there's right and wrong, or that there's an objective right and wrong? We evolved to the point of discovering them.
Yes.
Of discovering them.
But it's objective. What he's saying is we have to prevent speciation. I mean,
okay, yeah. That's very good. I think you stated very, very well what the answer would be. And so I'm going to pursue it a bit. Hopefully not, in any mean-spirited way, but...
If I could
just reply first, and then you could take the next one. Two points I'd like to make. And one is that there's something very dangerous about that argument. I think you fairly present it sort of like the standard response. And I think that there's something very dangerous, and that is this. What if it turns out to be the case, and just in purely pragmatic terms, nothing about morality, just absolutely pragmatic terms, that some form of eugenics is actually good for the race? To give an example, it is a fact in forestry that many of the great forests of the world are being seriously debilitated because of government programs to suppress and put out forest fires. And so when you have forest fires, it truly is survival of the fittest. And so one could argue, again, I'm going to put morality aside. This is just like an exercise in trying to think about these things. I'm actually not evil, to the best of my knowledge. But the idea here is that I think one could make an argument, whether or not people accepted it, but still one could make, I think, even a scientific argument, whether it turns out to be right or wrong, that that the real spirit of Darwin is precisely not to suppress programs like eugenics or wars in which the strongest survive. And that is survival of the fittest. That's what Darwin's really talking about. And the result of our programs to protect the young indiscriminately is actually a burgeoning population of unfit specimens, which really are not good, overpopulation. And so a good war, survival of the fittest, dramatic reduction of the Earth's population would be really good for us. That's one point I want to make. So you have a situation where, let's say, the opposition to genocide, the opposition to the most violent forms of racism and all that, the argument against it is just pragmatic, and if it turns out that you crunch the numbers another way, suddenly all that is okay. I mean, genocide's okay, the most violent forms of racism are okay, if you can just sort of work the numbers a little differently. And then another point is that if it turns out to be the case that let's say we discover right and wrong, that when you feel that people should not harm your loved ones, and that it's evil for them to do so, or any innocent person, that you're not, that's not just your imagination that you've been programmed to buy into. That's really true. It really is wrong. And so if that's the case, if there really is an objective moral universe or an objective moral dimension to the universe, then it seems to me the next logical question would be where'd it come from? Like, how did it get there? And because morality is something which really applies to people. I mean, people, like, in order to be a moral agent, in order to be morally responsible for your actions, you have to have a certain relevant level of consciousness, which is why, let's say, a 9-month-old infant is not, can't be still in this country, can't be tried as an adult, or and so on and so forth. So if there is an objective moral order which really exists outside of ourselves, then where did it come from? And if it comes from some kind of personal consciousness, then the idea that everything just evolves, it seems to me, would be might start to look like a naive explanation. Not to deny that there's a certain chronological development of species. You don't have to argue about the fossil record, despite the many anomalies in the fossil record, but still, the idea that unaided physical forces account for everything, I think you'd really have to rethink that if there is an objective moral dimension in the universe that exists outside of ourselves. So those are a few things that come to mind.
I'm not sure you answered my question.
Well, good. We'll pursue your...
So this is a twist again towards the avatar.
The what?
The
Avatar.
Yes.
The movie thing.
Yes.
So until this movie came out, we have been thinking as a common person, the incarnation or avatar, it's a thing of gods. Like we know Sri Krishna, Sri Rama, they had a different avatar. Until this movie came, I actually thought that way. Now, we know that a common person, I mean, in Hindu literature, we think something called as a rebirth, you know, you can have another birth. If you do papa or punya, then you can have a different birth. So how can you correlate a common person to a god like Sri Krishna? Can he have an avatar?
Well, clearly, James Cameron just sort of borrowed the term and used it in a different way. I mean, he wanted to make a good movie, and he thought that was kind of like a sexy term.
I don't tell properly that avatar. My sons have been telling me that you don't talk it properly, but, you know, I think we call it avatar in Korea.
Yeah, the word avatar has been used for thousands of years within a great civilization to mean something, and Jim Cameron decided to use it a different way. So
the question was,
yeah,
can a common person reach to that extent to have a different kind of, you know, that metaphysical state?
There is a term, there is a term in the Indian tradition called Shakti Avesh Avatar. Shakti Avesh, which means that the Shakti, the power of God, is invested in, you could say, a human being or a jiva, an individual soul. And so in that sense, someone can be, so to speak, empowered, literally empowered, an empowered avatar, where it's not God, but it's someone who does have extraordinary power in this world, somehow is a medium, sort of like channeling this extraordinary divine power. So that's also accepted as a category of avatar. No, I said equally. I said several times. I find both. Yeah, I mean, I think there's some truth to the general notion of creation. I think there's some truth to the general notion of evolution. I'm not categorically rejecting the idea of creation or evolution. I'm just saying, though, I think what we find, especially in this country, because you have these very polarized extremes, who you know, take. So I'm not rejecting the general notions. I would just accept a more nuanced version of creation or evolution. Please, I mean, please pursue your point if I didn't address your question.
You made it sound like Darwin was the orchestrator of Hitler's eugenics.
No, I specifically said that I don't blame him for that. From who?
From the families that had little pet dwarfs. What was the response you think they had to that?
I don't know.
The response was they went to a scientific meeting and they picketed outside because they felt that their way of life was being destroyed and that they didn't want it.
Where was this now? What group of people are we talking about? In this country?
And when the tests were being developed and being
right, developed, right.
They actually made a big deal about the fact that this is their life and they should choose whether to have this or not, which they can choose anyway. They don't have
right,
to
right, right.
They felt that that was something that was being taken away from them. They were belated. The scientists who thought he was helping the test
right.
To help
effect.
It was like Hitler.
How did you see that?
It's their choice.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I'm not, believe me, anti-science. I'm actually...
No, I know that, but I'm just saying is that where does this, why does this argument sound like Hitler's eugenics? Now, clearly it was wrong. The way it was formed, clearly it's wrong. But
by Hitler, you mean?
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. But if it's voluntary, as you said, then it's, I agree that it is a contribution.
They didn't even want the test off.
They what?
They did not want the test even off.
That's crazy. I mean, in my view.
That was
a yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that's silly because they may not want it, but other people may want it. You can't, everyone should have their choice.
Just answer my question. Now I got back to
the I actually am. I admire good science, and I'm in favor of it. It's
what is the science? It has to be verifiable.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's just like, for example, let's say take any country, it's America, Nigeria, Switzerland, Uruguay, any country. Within their legitimate boundaries, you know, people can appreciate what they do. But it's when you cross the boundaries, and so my objection is not at all to science. I actually am I really like science. I mean, I've benefited immensely in my own life, whether it's medical care or, you know, flying here, and so I'm all for science. What I object to is not science at all. So I think in general science is good. What I object to is what's called scientism. In other words, going beyond real science and making dogmatic or unverified claims. And so there are certain areas which are... So when a scientist is really doing science, I'm applauding. And I've benefited tremendously from science, and I'm all for it. I mean, I'm really happy when they make these new discoveries. It's just... But when they start to make, like, let's say, like philosophical claims or metaphysical claims, which are not really, you know, the evidence is not really there, then I think it just becomes oppressive.
Well, who should make metaphysical?
What's that?
Who should make metaphysical?
I mean, it was like this gentleman said, I think everyone has the freedom to, you know, to come to their own conclusions. If you're a theist, an atheist, an agnostic, you know that we have that freedom. Everyone is free to decide what they believe or don't believe or not sure about. However, when you use all the prestige of science, I mean, because I think among rational people it's kind of, you know, they respect it, to use that, to give an example, if I can give you one simple example of the tilt of our civilization, especially in the subculture called the academy. As a logical... You just bear with this for a minute. I'll try to make it brief. It's a logical principle. It's a logical principle that to affirm or deny a particular claim is within the same domain. I mean, to give an example of what I mean. Let's say you're teaching a course in your field, and you give a test, and someone writes an answer. And you mark the answer right or you mark the answer wrong. To mark the answer right or wrong, you have to have the same knowledge. I mean, you know, in other words, you have to know your field. And so if you say this is the right answer, the wrong answer, let's say in the field of gynecology, it's still a claim about gynecology. You say this is right or this is wrong. Or in algebra or any field. And so in the same way, in a public university like the University of Wisconsin, you can stand up and teach a course, let's say in Greek mythology, and you're absolutely free to say that there is no god named Zeus, makes, you know, sends the rain and thunder and so on. And then you can give all kinds of, because I've heard these explanations in the best universities. Give all kinds of explanations that it's because, you know, primitive people, this or that psychological or sociological reason, they invented this. So you can deny a religious claim. To say there's a god named Zeus is a religious claim. And so to deny that claim is also a religious claim. It's just like, let's say, in the field of algebra, to claim that an equation is wrong is to make a claim about algebra, or to claim that it's right. So if you affirm or deny a proposition within a field, you're claiming, it's equally a claim within that field. So to deny a religious claim is a religious claim. So in public universities, you can make religious claims as long as they're negative. But you cannot stand up in a public university and claim that Zeus is the god of weather. But you can deny that he is, even though those are equally religious claims.
No, the other way is not.
I'll go through the whole thing again if you want. It's logic. If you are giving a spelling test to a class, and you mark a word right or wrong, this is misspelled or this is properly spelled, in both cases, you are claiming to know something about spelling. In algebra, in gynecology, in biology, in history, if you affirm or deny a proposition, you are still making a claim within the realm of that proposition. Do you understand that point? So if you say that Zeus is not the god of rain, that is a religious claim, as much as saying that Zeus is the god of rain. It's very simple. Or, for example, in our culture, blind faith. Where is the balancing term blind doubt? In the academy, doubting is intellectually respectable, even if you don't have good reasons. Skepticism is an intellectually respectable position, especially about metaphysical things, but not believing. So all I'm trying to say is that our civilization is sort of tilted. Skepticism is a specific philosophical position which has a history. It's not just being intellectual. It's so science, I mean, believe me, I am actually quite enthusiastic about good science. As I said, I personally and all the people in my family, we've all benefited immensely from science. Yes?
So I have a question regarding the period of diagnosis of the disease. So yes. We do diagnose. Like cystic fibrosis or other diseases which are genetic diseases. So, and I completely agree that we should have a choice about whether we want that fetus or newborn baby, if it is diagnosed to have cystic fibrosis, we going to birth. So, does it contradict with the law of karma? Because we know that people get diseases due to their previous activities. So, does it contradict?
What is the result of cystic fibrosis? If a child is born with that, what does that mean?
Breathing problems.
Yeah,
mostly it's breathing.
That's a disease of lungs and diseases. And at the end, he has to transplant lungs, which is very difficult. So, I mean, most people die by the age of 50.
By the age of 50?
Yeah, so that's a genetic disease. And there are other diseases also that...
Sometimes, I mean, what occurs to me, and anyway, it's just... I'll just say it because it is what often occurs to me, is that if, let's say, a child was some, and you can see this child's going to have a problem, and then you let the child take birth, the child, that person, if they are not satisfied with the quality of their life, can always kill themselves. And so, to say that, for example, I know this child will not have a life where